Armed Forces of the United Nations, the Special Service Division of the War Department of the United States of America presents We Who Fight. We Who Fight calling the Army Hit Kit.
Connie Boswell singing an Army Hit Kit tune.
We Who Fight calling Little Norway.
Lieutenant Edward Baird reporting on Little Norway.
We Who Fight calling Sinbad of the U.S. Coast Guard. We Who Fight calling the Alcan Highway.
Lieutenant Colonel Roswell Rosengren reporting on the Alcan Highway.
For the right of free men to speak the truth as they see it. For their right to fear no man and walk honorably before God. For cooperation between nations, we who fight this war pledge ourselves to victory and a lasting peace.
This is Edwin C. Hill, inviting you to listen to We Who Fight. This is no storybook program. This is the true story, right from the lips of those who are in the fight. For all of you who can so proudly say, we who fight.
Some months after Norway was occupied by the Nazis in 1940, a training center for Norwegian flyers was set up in Toronto, Canada. To this camp called Little Norway, recruits came from all over the world, risking their lives to join the Royal Norwegian Air Force. One of these men is seated opposite me now. Because he has relatives still living in Norway, he has asked us not to use his real name, lest the Nazis and Quislings seek revenge on innocent people. Therefore, we shall just call him Lieutenant Edward Baird. When did you arrive at Little Norway, Lieutenant Baird?
I reached there in June 1941, after a trip which took me 3/4 of the way around the world. About 6 months after my country fell, I escaped to Sweden. From there, I traveled to Russia, Turkey, and Iraq to India, where I boarded one of our merchant ships, which took me across the Pacific to western Canada. Then I traveled across the continent to Toronto, where I joined hundreds of my countrymen at Little Norway.
Had you had any previous flying experience, Lieutenant?
Yes, Mr. Hill. I enlisted in the Air Force in 1939. I was just about to complete my training when the Nazis invaded my country. Of the 20 cadets in my class in Norway, 18 of us escaped to fly with the RAF.
Well, that's great. Well, then, I suppose you didn't need much additional training in Little Norway before you were ready to go into combat, did you, Lieutenant?
I had a 2-month refresher course in Canada and then went to England for further training before I was assigned to a British fighter squadron. By early 1942, we had enough trained Norwegian flyers and ground crew to be able to start a new all-Norwegian squadron with the RAF.
Where did all these men come from?
Some were already abroad, in England or the United States, as students. One man came from Manila. Many of our enlistments came from men in the merchant marine, whose ships were in foreign ports, or at sea 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 when not. But the majority took the shortest, though most perilous route of all, crossing the North Sea from Norway to England in fishing boats, sailboats, and in some cases even rowboats. There is at least one case of a young Norwegians kidnapping a sizable coastwise steamer from its captain and steering it safely to an English port.
And the...
very old, but we have learned to hate those who attacked us. We have seen how they treat women and children, as well as clergymen and teachers who had the courage to protest against Nazi barbarism. We are fighting to eliminate forever from the world this menace to the democratic civilization all of us love. And so, we are very happy at the record we have made in combat. My squadron alone has now accounted for nearly 50 Nazi planes. In the raid of Dieppe last summer, when hundreds of planes of both sides were in the air, we accounted for 14 of the enemy aircraft destroyed.
How many missions have you flown on, Lieutenant?
I made about 60 sorties over occupied territory in Belgium, France, and Holland. Sometimes as many as 4 or 5 in one day.
And what kind of missions do you usually fly on?
Many different kinds, really. We've flown as cover for convoys in the channel and on patrols. We've gone on what we call the rhubarbs, which are fast, low-flying raids over occupied Europe, shooting up locomotives, gun positions, and troop encampments.
Well, Lieutenant Berg, tell me, what brings you back here across the Atlantic?
The RAF believes that a man should not stay too long at one kind of job. I've been flying Spitfires for more than 15 months, and now I shall be assigned to a ferry command for a while. That's why I returned to Little Norway to get additional training. Soon I shall be joining the hundreds of pilots who are ferrying clouds of planes from American factories across the Atlantic to England.
Lieutenants, you men of Norway have already written an imperishable chapter in the history of this war against the Axis. As President Roosevelt said, if there's anyone who still wonders why this war is being fought, let him look to Norway. If there is anyone who has any delusions that this war could have been averted, let him look to Norway. And if there's anyone who doubts the democratic will to win, again I say, let him look to Norway. He will find in Norway at once conquered and unconquerable the answer to his question. Thank you for being with us, Lieutenant Edward Berg, and good luck. Small barroom across from the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Soldiers and sailors are lined up at the bar, and down at one are two old men, civilians, a little the worse for wear.
Well, Pat, let's be having one for the road now. I'm afraid to have another chance. I might begin seeing things. Don't worry, don't worry, Pat. In all the years I've been drinking, I've never started seeing things. Hey, hey, Mike, come on. Set us up two more.
Okay, me lad. If you know what you're doing.
If we know what we're doing. Ha!
John.
Hey, Pat, what is it now? Look on the store next year. You see what I see?
By all the snakes in Ireland. It's a dog, it is. Look what he's doing. My saints be praised. It's drinking a shot of liquor, it is. And look, Pat. It's laughing up that beer as a chaser. We'll get beer as a chaser. Hey, come on, Pat, let's get out of here.
Well, the odd part about that scene is that those men were not seeing things. Because it was a dog that set up at the bar and had a shot of liquor and a beer chaser. A real dog. As a matter of fact, that dog is the mascot of the Coast Guard cutter Kemble. And here now to tell you more about it is one of the members of the Kemble crew. He's sound man, second class, Ted Epperson. Has Sinbad seen any action, Ted?
Plenty, Mr. Hill. In the 6 years he's been aboard, he's been right on deck in more dirty weather and in more engagements, I'll bet, than any dog afloat. He's a real sea dog, all right. He's proven himself when the going is tough. But there's one thing that worries us. Sinbad has a bad habit.
Bad habit? Well, what's that, Ted?
Well, Mr. Hill, he just can't seem to lay off the liquor or women. Every time we put him to port, he gets blind.
Well, how on earth does he get the stuff?
Oh, that's easy for Sinbad. As soon as we tie up, he jumps off the ship and makes for the nearest waterfront bar. You go into the bar, look for a vacant stool, and then jump up on it. If the bartender isn't looking his way, Sinbad gives a short bark. Since he's known to all the bartenders on the coast of two continents, they know that bark means one whiskey with a beer chaser.
Well, aren't the bartenders somewhat surprised at the dog drinking?
No, they're all used to him. You see, Sinbad has been doing this for over 6 years, and bartenders, being a philosophical lot, a sort of live and let live group, they figure that if a dog wants a drink, then it's not their business to ask why, but to go ahead and serve him.
Well, but Ted, who pays for all these Sinbad drinks?
Any one of us who happens to be around, Mr. Hill. If we happen to stop in a bar that Sinbad's been in during the evening, the bartender will usually mention that fact to us. That means fork over 45 cents.
45 cents to throw? Well, he must drink pretty good whiskey. How many of these bars does Sinbad get into during an evening?
Usually about 8 or 10. And when it comes... And when he comes out of the last one, he's usually listening slyly to starboard. It's then he starts looking for someone off his ship. You see, he knows that when we see him in this condition, we'll put him in a cab and send him back to the ship where he can sleep it off.
Does he ever have a hangover, Ted?
Mr. Hill, he has the worst hangovers I've ever seen. Nothing human or canine could look on the world more darkly than Sinbad with a hangover. Our ship's doctor usually sees Sinbad through these crises with large doses of aspirin.
But the next night he goes back for more?
Yes, sir, Mr. Hill. As soon as his hangover is cured, you'll find him making his nightly rounds again. He's a darn good customer, and all the bartenders like him. As a matter of fact, Sinbad has more friends on both sides of the ocean than any of us aboard the Campbell. For instance, when we put into Ireland, Sinbad's arrival is always written up in the society columns, which is more attention than ever our CAO gets.
Well, incidentally, Ted, how does Sinbad get along with the officers?
Well, now, that's a funny thing, Mr. Hill. All the officers like Sinbad, but I'm sorry to say the feeling is not mutual. I'm afraid Sinbad has an aversion to gold braid. He's strictly an enlisted man's dog. He always sleeps with us and never ventures into the officer's quarters aboard ship. However, like all good sailors, he obeys an officer's command, and he's always on hand at roll call every morning when his name is called. However, there was one morning that I remember when he wasn't present. It was the only time he missed.
When was that, Ted? How?
We were in a certain port, and in the early morning, we got an emergency order to pull right out. The ship's siren sounded, and we got underway. But we found there was no Sinbad on board. Naturally, being an emergency, the ship couldn't wait. But Sinbad mustn't wait. But Sinbad mustn't wait. But Sinbad must off in some gutter. Must off in some gutter. Must off in some gutter. Must off in some... When we were... He came running. Without the CO gave him... Ever since then, Sinbad has made ever sailing on time.
Wine, women, and song. Well, Ted, you said a few minutes ago that one of Sinbad's troubles was women. Tell us about that.
Well, that's a sort of a delicate subject, Mr. Hill. But let's just say this. Although sailors have a girl in every port, Sinbad has several girls in every port. Somehow or other, he's smart enough to keep them separated, and he has never been caught two-timing by any of them. Each of his female friends think that they're the only one in his life. That's a trick that even I haven't mastered.
Well, I'm sure that the fellows listening would like to hear Sinbad bark. Suppose you bring him out here on this stage.
All right, Mr. Hill.
Listen, Ed.
Well, there he is. For those of you who can't see him, I'd like to say he's right here in front of us. I'd like to say that he's a chunky, barrel-chested, black-haired mongrel whose eyes are slightly bloodshot at this moment. Now, I don't believe Teddy's going to bark. We just have to take it for granted and let it go with that description. Now, tell me, does Sinbad make a good mascot?
The best, Mr. Hill. Although I've been telling you the bad side of Sinbad's life, I'd like to say that he's our good luck piece aboard the Campbell. When Sinbad is aboard, everything runs smoothly. He's a real mascot, and there's nothing any one of us wouldn't do for him.
Well, there's no doubt from all you've told me. I'd say that Sinbad is one of the smartest dogs I ever heard of.
You can say that again, Mr. Hill. Do you know that he's so smart that when we pull into a certain northern port, he never leaves the ship, and port, he never leaves the ship, and port, he never leaves the ship, and port, stays on board and gazes. He just stays on board and gazes so...
Why is that?
Well, why should he go ashore there, Mr. Hill? You see, there are no bars in that town. And the one female dog that used to live there died last year. Mr. Hill, as I said before, he's a smart dog.
Indeed he is. Indeed he is. And thank you for that. Boswell drop in on us is just like having Mom pull a steaming fresh apple pie right out of the oven. It's just that natural and good.
And having her sing one of the Army hit kit tunes, one of your favorites, makes it doubly good. In case you haven't sat in with us lately, perhaps you might not know all about the hit kit. In brief, those are the songs, both words and music, sent out by the music department of the Special Service Division of the War Department to you fighting men everywhere. There's a new crop of songs that's picked for the leading personalities of the entertainment world, whipped out to you by ship and plane every month. The hit kit is sent along with the hope that you, wherever you are, will get up your own group and sing them, even if you personally think you can't carry a tune in a bucket. And to illustrate that fine old simple as ABC method of singing a song, we have right here Miss Connie Boswell.
Thank you, Frank.
Connie, here's the latest song sheet for the hit kit. Now, you just take your pick.
Okay, here I go. Well, Ed, this is what the boys in the back room call a lead pipe sink. I'd never be able to throw another fortissimo across the Mason-Dixon line again if I didn't pick this last one.
Well, Connie, you couldn't mean that song called Dinah.
Then which there is nothing finer.
Well, we'll buy that, Connie. When you see an opening, just slip in.
Oh, Dinah, is there anyone finer in the state of Carolina? If there is, and you know her, show her to me, Dinah, with the Dixie eyes blazing. How I love to sit and gaze into the eyes of Dinah Lee. Now every night, why do I shake with fright? Because my dynamite turned him on about me. Oh, Dinah, if she wanted to China, I would hop an ocean liner just to be with Dinah Lee.
Mountains are nameless, and the rivers all run God knows where. There are lives that are erring and aimless, and death is just hanged by the hair. There are hardships that nobody reckons. There are valleys unpeopled and still. There's a land, oh, it beckons and beckons. And I want to go back, and I will.
Yes, those words describe the Yukon. And many a young fellow, probably even some of you men listening, have at one time or other read those words of Robert W. Services and thought how awful it would be to be up in that country. Now there's some Army engineers up there who are finding out for themselves, finding out in a way that's even more vivid than Service put it, because they're living there, building one of the greatest developments ever undertaken by the United States Army, the Great Alaskan Highway. Here now on We Who Fight to tell you all about what these men are going through, how they're living, and about this great new triumph of engineering, is a man who's an officer, the United States Army Engineer. He knows of that way of life. He's been up there. He's lived with the men. And fellows, I want you to meet Lieutenant Colonel R.P. Rosengren of the United States Army Engineers. All right, Colonel Rosengren, go ahead.
Well, Mr. Hill, on February 2nd, 1942, Brigadier General Sturdivant, Corps of Engineers, was called into the office of the Chief of Staff and told that a decision had been reached to undertake the construction of a highway to Alaska over a route connecting a series of airfields from Fort St. John, British Columbia, to Big Delta in Alaska, a distance of about 1,600 miles. He was told that the Chief of Engineers would carry out the project, that a plan for survey and construction must be submitted within the next few days. Such a plan was submitted on February 4th, 2 days later, and a final directive to proceed with the project was received on February 14th. That means, Mr. Hill, that within 12 days, plans were drawn up and approved for a 1,600-mile highway through British Columbia, the Yukon, and Alaska, 1,000 miles of which had never been tried.
Colonel, when did the first troops start working on the highway?
Well, actual work began when the preliminary surveying was done in March, a month after the original plans were drawn. At that time, the proposed route was surveyed by engineers in airplanes, by dog team, and on foot. In April, a regiment of engineers arrived at the southern tip of the proposed highway and marched their supplies 325 miles through the wilderness to a base where they were to be set up at Fort Nelson. And that march was made in weather 40 degrees below zero and with the heaviest equipment carried by any soldier. 12 days after they had arrived there in April, the spring thaws, which they had been racing, blotted them out completely from any contact with the rest of the world. And so there they sat, isolated and alone, until July, when the climate allowed them to go to work.
Well, Colonel Rosengren, what sort of terrain did the men have to get through in order to build the highway?
First of all, there was a solid wall of forest stretching for most of those 1,600 miles. They had to get over mountain passes up to 4,200 feet high. They had to fight mud so deep even tractors were swallowed up. Cold, drizzling rain, ice, and worst of all, bottomless muskeg swamps.
It sounds incredible. I don't see how it was done.
I think General Pershing put it best when at the end of the last war, he said this about the engineers. Scientists said it couldn't be done, but the damn fool engineers didn't know any better, so they did it.
And I know, Colonel, that the engineers have been doing just that for many years.
Yes, for 168 years, to be exact, ever since George Washington commissioned the first engineer.
Well, Colonel, tell us some more about your problems in building that great Alaska highway.
Well, Mr. Hill, there was the ever-present problem of weather. Weather that ranged from 72 degrees below zero to 90 degrees above. And then there were the lakes and rivers that had to be crossed. As a matter of fact, there were over 200 rivers that had to be bridged. And don't forget, each of these bridges had to be carved out of native timber by hand.
Had the country through which the highway runs, had that ever been fully explored?
No, sir, not in its entirety. As a matter of fact, there was a stretch of that 1,000 miles that had never been explored. But there the men ran against the same obstacles. Frost, cold, mountains, and rivers.
Terrific. How did the men stand up against such hardships?
I've never seen or been associated with finer, healthier, or tougher outfits of soldiers than those engineers who worked on the Alaskan highway. I've talked with men who've had their shoes cut from their frozen feet, whose hands literally froze to the outside of door handles, to a sergeant attacked by a bear while swimming and who drove him off with a punch in the nose. But our men survive and thrive because they soon learn the secret of the North Country. If you fight it, you'll lose. But like all strange lands, wherever you may be, if you use it, learn to understand it, make stepping stones out of the stumbling blocks, you'll win. And as Robert Service says, it takes you to its bosom.
Well, that seems like sound advice, Colonel. Tell me exactly how long did it take you to build that 1,600-mile highway?
Well, Mr. Hill, some experts said it would take anywhere from 5 to 6 years. But the Army engineers did it in 4 months. Those men actually worked 7 days a week and worked every day until exhausted.
Amazing. I know that many of the men would probably like to know the answer to this question. I'm sure you can give it to them. Why was the Alaskan Highway built?
Well, with the Jap attack from the west, which was stopped only 60 miles from our vital base at Dutch Harbor, that threatening the water route to Alaska, plus an extreme scarcity of shipping, with a series of airfields there already pioneered by the Canadians, and the necessity of supplying the airfields and Alaska, the road just had to be built, and it had to follow this route. It now stands as a safeguard to one of our richest possessions.
Colonel, what does this highway look like now that it's completed?
Well, it isn't a national park highway, and it isn't just a tote road washed out by the spring thaw. It's a military highway, pure and simple, and a damn good one at that. So good that I had to constantly slow down my driver from 40 and 50 miles an hour to a speed where I could make the observations of my mission. Now the Alaskan highway stands as a monument. A monument to guts. A monument to real men. A monument to the teamwork of soldiers. The kind of teamwork, Mr. Hill, that will wipe out Jap and Nazi militarism forever.
Thunderstorm. Every week at this time, We Who Fight will bring You Who Fight, the dramatic true stories of this global war. This is Edwin C. Hill speaking for the armed forces of the United Nations. In heat or cold, on sand or sea, go We Who Fight to victory.
Music on We Who Fight was played by the Fort Slocum Band. This program was produced by the Special Service Division of the War Department of the United States of America. We'll be right back.